congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
This is Exopolitics Radio, KPHX Phoenix, 1480 AM, Nova M Radio, 1480kphx.com. Our audio archives are at www.exopoliticsradio.com. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. If you're joining us for the first time tonight, we're a weekly exopolitical public affairs talk show exploring the evidence and impact of intelligent, organized life in the universe on our human society. And today we have a very special program, Exopolitics, War and Peace. And just looking at what is occurring in the Matrix world of War and Peace is very apropos, as there is a countdown orchestrated by manipulation both sides of the Hegelian dialectic of enemies in the permanent war economy, leading to a vital question of war and peace, or war or peace. Our program today is two important segments. The first is part one of a 60-minute interview with Dr. Michael Sala of the Exopolitics Institute on exopolitics and nuclear weapons, covering President Dwight D. Eisenhower's reported February 20th, 1954 meeting with extraterrestrial ambassadors, followed by a segment on extraterrestrials and peace, and that is another official Exopolitics Radio commentary on the context communication theory, following our commentary on the Chicago O'Hare sighting. We'll be parsing the Cleveland March 10th, 2007 UFO sighting over a peace rally and the key tower in downtown Cleveland. Is it war and peace, or war or peace? This is a multi-dimensional reality, and exopolitics is central to it, and Exopolitics Radio is there to cover it with you. Please stay tuned. We'll be back right after the break. Thank you.
This is Exopolitics Radio, KPHX Phoenix, 1480 AM, Nova M Radio, 1480kphx.com on the internet. Our audio archives are at www.exopoliticsradio.com. I'm your host, Alfred Weber, and today we have as our special guest and commentator Dr. Michael E. Sala, a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, the scholarly study of the main actors, institutions, and processes associated with an extraterrestrial presence that is not acknowledged to the general public, elected officials, or the mass media. His groundbreaking Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence, Dandelion Books, 2004, presents the first scholarly framework for understanding the political implications of extraterrestrial presence. Dr. Sala is an internationally recognized scholar in international politics, conflict resolution, and U.S. foreign policy, and is the author, editor of an additional four books, including The Hero's Journey Toward a Second American Century, Essays on Peace, Why the Cold War Ended, and Islamic Radicalism, Muslim Nations, and the West. Welcome, Michael.
Aloha, Alfred. Glad to
yes,
be.
I would like to add for our listening audience that you're coming to us from Kona, Hawaii, where the Exopolitics Institute, which you founded, is located. And I wish you could tell us a bit about the Exopolitics Institute.
Well, yes, this is where the Institute was founded, and it really grew out of experiences I had at American University, where I was employed for a number of years as an assistant professor, and then I was there as a researcher in residence. And what I found was that when I got involved in exopolitics research, not only was there opposition to me doing this work, people tried to silence me. I mean, I was told that working on areas that would in any way embarrass the university would jeopardize my position. And later on, I believe we'll be talking a little bit about how my research on the Eisenhower extraterrestrial meeting did lead to that. And so what I decided to do afterwards, after that very negative experience, was that I realized that it would be important to create an institute, an organization that could support scholars in the field doing this work, because it really does threaten their careers. And then you have had that experience yourself many years ago as to how damaging that is to one's profession if they fall out of their superiors when it comes to doing these groundbreaking works on exopolitics.
Right. Well, you know, I'm here looking at a Washington Post story, and it dated February 19th, 2004, entitled Ike and the Alien Ambassadors, The Whole Truth About the President's Extraterrestrial Encounter, by Peter Carlson, Washington Post staff reporter. And maybe I should read the first couple of paragraphs, because it's a sort of a journalistic kickoff, I think, to what is a very deep story. 50 years ago tomorrow, on February 20th, 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower interrupted his vacation in Palm Springs, California, to make a secret nocturnal trip to a near-far by Air Force base to meet two extraterrestrial aliens. Or maybe not. Maybe Ike just went to the dentist. There's some dispute about this. The Ike met with ET theory is advanced by Michael Sala, a former American University professor who now runs the Peace Ambassador Program at American University's Center for Global Peace. The Ike went to the dentist theory is advanced by the folks at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas, and by James M. Mixon, a dentist, professor of dentistry, and historian of presidential dental work. Just to make things more intriguing, on the night in question, the Associated Press reported this: President Eisenhower died tonight of a heart attack in Palm Springs, end of quote. 2 minutes later, the AP retracted the bulletin and reported that Ike was still alive. Indeed, Ike was alive, and he continued living until 1969. Well, Michael, I think it's fair to say that you're one of the authorities on the night of February 20th, 1954, and I wondered if you could lead us through a conversation of what led you to think that this encounter took place. And I know that you've assembled a whole tapestry of evidence, so please tell us.
Yes, Alfred, there's a lot of evidence here. There's circumstantial evidence in the form of events surrounding what happened on that evening of February 20, 1954. There are some direct witnesses who have come forward and related what occurred. Whistleblowers have also spoken about this, and there are also supporting research done by a number of researchers. So maybe I can go through each of these. In terms of what occurred on the evening of February 20, 1954, the official explanation is that President Eisenhower went to Palm Springs for a week-long vacation with his family, and on that particular night, he disappeared because he needed some emergency dental work. And then he turned up the next morning for an official function at a church. Well, the problem with that story, first off, is that it's been discovered that that is a cover story, that in fact there was no evidence that the dentist who claimed, who was said to have treated him, actually did treat him. There was no follow-up in the official presidential archives for this dentist having received any notification for having treated the president, which is in itself very unusual, because typically what happens is that anyone rendering a service to any president gets a letter of thanks from the White House, and this happens in all cases. So if this dentist did treat the president, why didn't he receive an official thank you? That's just one of the anomalies. One of the other things that is peculiar about the case is that the dentist later was interviewed, or his wife was interviewed, and there was no recollection of exactly what happened with the treatment of Eisenhower. So again, this kind of helps give circumstantial evidence that in fact something else was occurring and that this dentist story was in fact a cover. Now, I actually have spoken personally to a whistleblower, someone who worked at a nearby airbase, McGeorge Air Base, who says that on that night of February 20, that his friend, who worked as an army medic, went to an airbase where Eisenhower flew in and then flew off to Edwards Air Force Base in another Air Force jet. Now, what that suggests is that the idea that President Eisenhower was just at Palm Springs for a vacation and for some golf is really fictitious, that there was something else happening here that was significant enough for a cover story to be developed and for his movements to be very mysteriously covered up. And so that's what happened in terms of him being spirited off to this meeting that allegedly occurred at Edwards Air Force Base. Now, as for the meeting itself, this meeting is really one that is really quite momentous for all humanity, because this is allegedly the first official meeting between a representative of a major world government and visiting extraterrestrials. And what the extraterrestrials allegedly told President Eisenhower is quite remarkable. They basically told him that the development of the hydrogen bomb and the testing of these weapons, thermonuclear weapons, was a great risk not only to humanity but also impacted in some negative ways on extraterrestrial civilizations themselves. So the extraterrestrials who met with Eisenhower asked that the U.S. abandon its thermonuclear weapons program and adopt a more peaceful or more ethical approach to the development and use of weapon systems, and also be prepared to disclose to the American public the presence of visiting extraterrestrials from other worlds. So this is quite momentous, and of course not something that was going to be decided upon very lightly by national security advisors. And so this is really the context for that meeting on February 20 at Edwards Air Force Base.
Right. Now, do we have independent sources that confirm or give us some account of what went on at that meeting?
Yes, we do. We have a number of direct witnesses and a number of whistleblowers who have come forward. There are a number of these, so I can run through them pretty quickly. First is a former Navy commander, Charles Suggs, who told his son what had happened, that Charles Suggs was present at the meeting and was offering President Eisenhower some protective services, and he related how two extraterrestrials who looked very Nordic, very Scandinavian in appearance, very tall, blonde hair, and how they met with President Eisenhower and discussed with him these themes. There's also an incident described by Timothy Good, who discusses Lord Clancutty, a member of the British House of Lords, who met with a high-level whistleblower who described also being present at the meeting where Eisenhower met with human-looking extraterrestrials that emerged from a number of space vehicles. And finally, there's another direct witness, an evangelist by the name of Gerald Light, who claims that he was there as part of a number of citizens who would offer kind of wise men's perspective on what to do concerning the issues confronting extraterrestrials coming and giving this kind of information to the president. Apparently, this incident was filmed, which is quite remarkable, that we have on film the evidence of President Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials. Two sources have confirmed the existence of this film. One is a whistleblower by the name of Don Phillips, who was a Disclosure Project witness, and he discussed seeing this film of the 1954 meeting. Another is a priest, a Jesuit priest from the Vatican, who also confirmed the existence of this film, and incidentally was able to confirm that the Catholic Church sent its representative, Cardinal McIntyre, to be part of a wise men's group that observed and gave feedback on what would be the best thing to do. And there are a number of other whistleblowers who have also come forward and discussed what they have seen in documents that are possessed by a number of military departments. So all up, there's a number of independent sources and actual film allegedly existing that confirmed that President Eisenhower did in fact meet with extraterrestrials on the evening of February 20, 1954. And that was the first of a series of meetings that eventually led up to agreements with extraterrestrial visitors.
There were different groups of extraterrestrial visitors.
That's correct. That's an important point to make here, that in fact the conditions that were required by this first group of extraterrestrials, that the United States give up its thermonuclear program and essentially take a more ethical approach to disclosing the existence of extraterrestrials and also managing these destructive technologies that are being developed by the military, that those terms were unacceptable to the advisors of President Eisenhower, and we're talking here about his military advisors. And what that meant was that another group of extraterrestrials would then be able to come forward and offer terms that were more acceptable to the U.S. national security elite. And essentially these terms made possible for the extraterrestrials to provide technology to the U.S. military, and in exchange, the extraterrestrials would be given basing rights, they would be given some resources, and also that they would be able to participate in a limited, monitored abduction program.
Is there any indication, Michael, of what the provenance of these are? That is, who these two indicated that they represented?
Well, I have heard a number of different sources on that. One suggests that they were from the Pleiades. Another source suggests that they are from the solar system itself. Now, I haven't been able to confirm that, and there really isn't that much evidence available to conclusively determine one way or the other where they came from. But certainly those that witnessed them saw that these were beings who possessed anti-gravity devices, flying saucers that flew in, and that the beings themselves were extraterrestrial biological entities in terms of being very tall, like around the 7-foot mark, and that they possessed these advanced technologies. So we know that these were off-world beings, but it's still not clear as to where they come from. And there have been, as I said, secondary sources claiming that they come from the Pleiades or other parts of the solar system, but that is not something that I've been able to confirm at this stage.
Now, from the accounts of the meeting itself, what you say is that they asked for a condition, and that is that the U.S. abandon its nuclear weapons program. Do we have any further details of any conditions laid around this, or if the U.S. did that, then what course would be taken?
Well, the context of the discussions was that the nuclear weapons testing program was a great threat, and that in order for this particular group of extraterrestrials to help with the development of humanity, that they required that testing to come to an end. Essentially, they were arguing that humanity's technological development had outstripped its ethical responsibilities, so that there was great concern that these weapons would be put to some use, as indeed occurred during the Second World War, to bring that to an end. So the extraterrestrials were concerned that that would be repeated in the future, but this time using far more powerful weapon systems. Now, the thing is, what we need to remember is that with thermonuclear weapons, or the hydrogen bomb, these bombs were at a level of 1,000 times more powerful than the weapons dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For example, the weapons dropped at Nagasaki were in the 15 kiloton range. So that's 15,000 tons of TNT that were dropped on both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, with the hydrogen bomb test, the Bravo test that was in fact to occur 9 days after the meeting, and that's significant itself, that this alleged meeting happened 9 days before the Bravo test. That was a 15 megaton hydrogen bomb test. Now that is 1,000 times more powerful than the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima. So I think we can see quite clearly the dangers in these levels of weapons being developed and possibly being used if the circumstances deemed them necessary according to policymakers. And I think the extraterrestrials quite rightly perceive that the development of such destructive weapons, when our own ethical development had still not moved ahead that much, was a cause for great concern. And so this, I believe, was really the background for the conditions laid out by the extraterrestrials for an agreement being reached with President Eisenhower and his national security team.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Michael, is that I've just returned from a war crimes conference in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and part of the expert testimony that was presented there by a number of scientists was that the nanoparticle radiation in the Earth's atmosphere from nuclear testing, from nuclear power plants, which is like a low-level nuclear explosion, but which were developed from the hydrogen bomb program, and from depleted uranium weapons, which were developed in 1943 at the same time as the atomic bomb. And in fact, the nuclear bombs are actually wrapped in thousands of pounds of depleted uranium around a plutonium core, so that when that plutonium core explodes, all of these nanoparticles of depleted uranium are spread throughout the upper atmosphere. That radiation has now spread around the globe in such a way that the public health indicators in mortality, in increase in cancer, various sorts of cancers, in increase in infant mortality, in increase in diabetes, in decreases in SAT scores, I mean, whatever sort of indices, it's almost like a depopulation program from the nuclear weapons program that started with the testing. So perhaps the ETs, you know, they're pointing to some very real results that we're feeling now.
Well, this is exactly the point that I think those who have come forward to reveal the Eisenhower ET meeting have made, that in fact the ETs that approached Eisenhower were very, very concerned about the lack of moral integrity or principles in developing and using nuclear technology. I mean, as you said, as you've just described, these weapons testing programs have continued, and that there has been great concern that this has polluted the environment and, in fact, is continuing now with the use of depleted uranium in weapons that are increasingly being used in more conventional military theaters. And so this tends to support the idea that the extraterrestrials were right, that in the absence of a kind of ethical, sufficient ethical development, that humanity, or at least the military, would misuse these nuclear technologies. And that seems to have been exactly what has occurred.
And I just want to mention, Michael, because you're in the Big Island there, that I was informed of it while I was in Japan on Oahu, where the military has been testing depleted uranium weapons. A woman who has been cleaning out the Schofield military barracks there, that was her job as a cleaning woman, just gave birth to a baby that was born with its intestines outside of the body, i.e., very much like the birth defects that the Iraq soldiers and the Iraqi civilians are giving because of the damaged DNA from the nanoparticles of the depleted uranium radiation in Iraq. So that is, the depleted uranium is beginning to contaminate even the Hawaiian Islands.
Well, this is part of the concern that many Hawaiians have with the expansion of the training facility, which is situated between Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa here on the Big Island, that in fact there's an attempt to have the Striker Brigade train here on the Big Island and expand the present training facility on the Big Island so that this Stryker Brigade could come from Oahu and test its weapons. And so this has led to the concern of many citizens on the Big Island that, in fact, some of this weapons testing would involve depleted uranium. So there are increasing protests even here on the Big Island about this. And certainly
yes, and I think that the Hawaiian House of Representatives just passed a bill 72-0, and it's now at the Senate, to require testing of soldiers for DU.
Well, it's very important to be aware of how these nuclear technologies...
Yes, right. Well, now, back square again, so that these Nordic ETs, and I realized that after this meeting, they went on to a whole series of other agreements, but I still want to stay with this because the consequences of, as you stated, what was it, 9 days after this meeting, the U.S. went ahead with a scheduled hydrogen bomb test of 15 megatons. Is that what you...
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. Now, just to ask you this, in your book, you point out how there were a number of groups that, in effect, privatized or left the U.S. president out of the loop on extraterrestrial policy issues. And these were groups that were instigated by the Rockefeller brothers, David and Nelson, through their policy operative Henry Kissinger, PI-40, the study group, and perhaps others. I don't have the timing sequence exactly. Perhaps you could clarify here. Just to ask you this question. Here, Eisenhower meets on February 20th. Suppose he is genuinely concerned and takes the issue under advisement, and then, without any notice, the sort of militaristic forces just go ahead with the hydrogen bomb test without any referral to him, or do you think that Eisenhower took the matter under advisement, decided to reject this overture by the Nordic extraterrestrials, and then gave the order to go ahead with the hydrogen bomb test?
Well, I think Eisenhower is a very interesting figure historically, and he is someone, having been the former commander of the Allied forces in Europe, he is someone that had a lot of military credibility. And so if anyone could have swayed the military from committing itself to a policy of developing nuclear weapons, it would have been him. And it's interesting that the meeting with the Nordic extraterrestrials happened 9 days before the Bravo test. And now, obviously, that means that everything had been moved, basically the preliminary planning had been finalized, that everything was set for this test. Now, 9 days before is really a very short time. So what that suggests to me is that Eisenhower responded to an overture by the extraterrestrials to meet urgently as a last-scale effort to prevent this testing from going ahead. And I think he responded favorably to that. The fact that it occurred 9 days before suggests that this was really Eisenhower's attempt to see if he could put a stop to this. It's interesting also that historically the very first nuclear weapon, the very first hydrogen bomb test, occurred under President Truman just a few days before President Eisenhower was elected in 1952. So the very first hydrogen bomb test occurred on November 1st, 1952, and then President Eisenhower was elected just a few days later. So this occurred before he had the power to say yes or no. So there were forces that were keen to start a nuclear weapons program using thermonuclear weapons before Eisenhower came in. So in other words, it was like he would be forced to accept this as a fait accompli. And so that's the kind of preliminaries for this later meeting in 1954 when the second ever hydrogen bomb test is scheduled to go ahead. And this appeared to be something that Eisenhower was interested in discussing with the extraterrestrials to maybe put a stop to it. And I think the role of the Rockefellers and Henry Kissinger in privatizing the military's various weapons procurement programs and getting corporations involved was critical for this. And I think they began a process of slowly taking power away from the president and vesting it in what we now understand to be the military-industrial complex.
Industrial complex. You know, I'm going to jump right in here. We're coming to the end of this very interesting discussion, and we certainly want to continue these threads. And we have maybe room for just a minute or so of comment, kind of a sum of comment, if you'd like to make it.
Well, I think this whole area of the result of extraterrestrials interacting with political leaders and opportunities to pass more peaceful policies is something that we really need to study closely, and that is something that I've been doing, and I know you've been doing that for a number of years through your organizations. And it's something we're doing at various conferences that we have been organizing through the Institute. And I just encourage listeners to visit the website for the forthcoming conference we have in Hawaii in May, which is www.earthtransformation.com, to look at some of the issues that we are investigating and see the links to the 2006 conference where we tackled some of these issues directly, and there are DVDs and links there for people to explore. So I just want to thank you, Alfred, for having me on the show and giving me the opportunity to talk about this very important incident that occurred just over 50 years ago.
Yes, Michael, thank you very much. We look forward to your continued participation and very valued commentary here on Exopolitics Radio. We've had as our special exopolitics commentator today Dr. Michael Sala, director of the Exopolitics Institute. This is Exopolitics Radio, KPHX Phoenix, 1480 AM Nova M Radio, www.1480kphx.com. Our audio archives are at www.exopoliticsradio.com. I am your host, Alfred Weber. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio, KPHX Phoenix, 1480 AM, Nova M Radio, 1480kphx.com. Our audio archives are at www.exopoliticsradio.com, and we understand that people are starting to really flock there to hear our past shows. They're like an exopolitics curriculum, and if you'd like to catch up on the news from the extraterrestrial or exopolitical point of view, that's where you go, folks. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. Welcome back to this key program, Exopolitics, War, and Peace. And indeed, we're sort of at the juncture of war and peace here on this, our fragile planet Earth. This is another official Exopolitics Radio commentary, this one continuing on the extraterrestrial context communication theory. Those of you who may have listened, if not, we will catch you up. Basically, what the context communication theory states is that extraterrestrial or UFO encounters can be viewed as multidimensional communications from an intelligent source to our human society, much like a dream is a multidimensional communication, a symbolic communication from your subconscious mind to your conscious mind. And if you go to a bookstore or to your psychologist or your counselor or your psychiatrist, I say that because I graduated from the University of Texas as a counselor, so I always say you're. I assume that counseling is something that, you know, is like normal in today's world. You use dream dictionaries, you know, so that you can review your dreams and look at the various symbolic ways. Well, in the same way, UFO encounters, genuine UFO encounters, are symbolic. And so what we analyzed in a past program was the now famous Chicago O'Hare sighting of November 7th, 2006, when a 6 to 26 foot UFO, unidentified flying object, sort of flying saucer, came down on Concourse C, gate C-17 of United Airlines of Chicago O'Hare's Airport, right in the middle of the flight day as they were backing a plane in, one of the United Airlines jet planes, and it was seen by air traffic controllers, airline personnel, etc. And it's been quite the buzz. It was featured on National Public Radio, Chicago Tribune, major media. And everyone's saying, what does it mean? Well, by the context communication theory, you look at it and, hey, one of the primary coordinates is the date. And the date was November 7th, 2006, which was midterm election day in the United States. And not only that, it wasn't just any midterm election day. It was the date in which the neoconservatives, the war party, by some view, lost control of both the U.S. Senate by one vote and the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, that UFO in that picture could have either been a genuine extraterrestrial craft or what they call an alien reproduction vehicle. And these are alien reproduction vehicles are part of a fleet that is owned and operated by the secret black budget of the U.S. and other military intelligence. The black budget estimated at $1.5 trillion per year, and they have back engineers using anti-gravity and or other propulsion systems. So looking at that vehicle that was involved, it looked like a probe vehicle and very well may have been a genuine extraterrestrial vehicle that came down in Chicago O'Hare's airport on midterm election day. So what we said from an ET context communication point of view is that whatever the intelligence behind that sighting, that communication, if we assume that it's genuine ET, is they're saying, hey, this is an important date. This is where exopolitics meet politics. This is where the neoconservatives, the Bush administration, which had in plan ever since the false flag operation of September 11, 2001, the imposition through the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, of a virtual police state inside the United States and North America through the purported North American Union or Security and Prosperity Partnership with Canada and Mexico. This is where they lost total power of all three branches of the government, the executive, the judiciary, and the Congress. Now you can say, well, are the Democrats and the Republicans at some deeper level in on the permanent war economy, at least at some leadership level? Well, that's a slightly different question. At least there was an opening here. So that's what we talked about last week. And no other analyst, is no other font of analysis other than Exopolitics Radio, is talking about, gee, the Chicago O'Hare sighting happened on U.S. midterm election day. That's the key. What that might be saying is that the Exopolitics agenda is going to become key in the U.S. presidential race of 2008. And so we at Exopolitics Radio committed ourselves to that. Well, there's been another sighting since in Cleveland on March 10th, 2007. That's the very date that Exopolitics Radio launched. And that was Saturday, March 10th, 2007. And we're going to play that for you now. It's going to take just about a minute and a half. So here we go. Okay, so you have now heard the newscast of the March 10th, 2007, Cleveland Peace Rally Key Tower UFO sighting. So let's begin to look at that one from the context communication theory of extraterrestrial communication. Now, first of all, is the craft in that a genuine extraterrestrial craft? We consulted some of our consultants who examined the craft, and as to whether that craft is a genuine extraterrestrial craft or an alien reproduction vehicle, there isn't a complete agreement, but the balance of the opinion seems to be that it could very well be a genuine extraterrestrial craft, although it could be an alien reproduction vehicle, and that is a black budget vehicle hovering above the Key Tower and the peace rally in Cleveland, Ohio, which was to get the U.S. out of Iraq on March 10th, 2007, as part of psychological warfare by the national security state of the United States. And that is, from that point of view, the U.S. Space Command has a motto of total spectrum dominance. So they would take their alien reproduction vehicles and fly it over a peace rally to sort of introduce psychological warfare to confuse people as to whether extraterrestrials are for peace or are these extraterrestrials or not, so that they would be the extraterrestrials. It's like in the old days where, you know, they infiltrate agents or cops into the peace movement. Well, now they're infiltrating agents or cops into the extraterrestrials. But the preponderance of opinion at this point is that it could very well be an extraterrestrial vehicle. And by the way, if you'd like to see that clip, please go to www.exopolitics.com. Now, taking the extraterrestrial context communication theory, that sighting is in Cleveland on March 10th over the Key Tower, and the symbolic elements, just at the very simple level, are that, hey, the extraterrestrial vehicle is over a peace rally, so it's a peace rally to keep the U.S., get it out of Iraq. There's now threatening war in Iran, which could lead to conflagration. All of these wars are part of the permanent war economies rollout of war as part of a global depopulation plan to depopulate the planet by at least one-third, to kill off 2 billion human beings on behalf of the elite that control wealth and resources on the planet. You know, if one gets into the matrix of patriotism, one is lost. To the permanent war economy, war is an industry, and it's the same parties manipulating the dialectic of enemies on both sides to create this war. So the context communication theory of the Cleveland March 10th sighting over the peace rally over the Key Tower in downtown Cleveland, Ohio, is peace is key. Our citizenry standing up for peace is key to a future world and to a future exopolitical world. Isn't it interesting that Cleveland, Ohio, is the home of yet another Democratic candidate, Representative Dennis Kucinich, who was the sponsor of the Space Preservation Act, the sponsor of the Department of Peace Act, who was the one presidential candidate who has consistently been against the war in Iraq, who is a U.S. presidential candidate now. If we go to the Chicago O'Hare sighting, that's the home of two of the U.S. presidential candidates. Number one, Illinois Senator Barack Obama, a Democratic presidential candidate. And number two, it's the family home of Senator Hillary Clinton. Now, all three of those candidates will have positions on exopolitics and will have positions on war and peace. But if those are extraterrestrial craft, it could have been that it was an ET craft in the O'Hare sighting and an alien reproduction craft in the Cleveland sighting, or both are extraterrestrial craft. It seems that we are now entering a phase, exopolitics, or the relations between our human civilization and extraterrestrial civilizations, is becoming a key actor in fundamental questions of our human survival around issues of war and peace. We would urge listeners to Exopolitics Radio to begin to look into things like the events, extraterrestrial events, or even alien reproduction vehicle events, like the O'Hare sighting and the Cleveland sighting, with the new depth that we are presenting here, to examine the possibilities as our globe heads for some very difficult times, that are obviously pre-engineered by the permanent war economy and what we call the International War Crimes Racketeering Organization, which have imposed the information embargo against advanced ethical extraterrestrial civilizations over the past 60 years. These are some very thoughtful times and some very deep times that should take us deep within ourselves to contemplate what our brothers and sisters in the rest of the galaxy, what messages they may have for us. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. I'll return right after the break. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. We had originally planned to have Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle on this week, and these breaking events of Exopolitics, War and Peace intervene. So we thought it important to present these developments to you, our Exopolitics Radio audience, and to give you the tools by which you can begin to bring a broader and deeper understanding of the events that are transpiring on our fragile planet inside our solar system and galaxy at this time. We'll be back next week with Dr. Rebecca Hardcastle, who's an originator and researcher in the field of exoconsciousness, or the inherited extraterrestrial consciousness that we all carry, which brings us to the world within and its connection to the larger universe, which is an appropriate direction after the outer world of war and peace that we've been exploring. Please visit our audio archives at www.exopoliticsradio.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can email the host. Please ask us any questions. We'll get back to you. And you can order your personally autographed copy of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. I'm your host, Alfred Weber. May you have a wonderful, multidimensional, and miracle-filled day, week, and life. Thank you.